Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another week on the Damage Report. I am John Iderola. It's Monday, of course, and so Brooke joins me.
Yay!
Brooke Thomas in studio. Always glad to have you here.
You know, I like being here so much, and I say that, and I'm like, people are like, who are watching, are like, okay, wow, wow, wow. But it's a good way to start your Monday.
It's not bad.
You know, we clearly, you know, don't know anything about each other, hostmates,
but we
enjoy each other, and I think that's what matters.
Yes, we will get to know each other. Do you have a middle name?
Do you know my middle name? Alan.
No, it's not Alan.
I know. I'm sorry.
It's Matthew.
That was gonna be my next choice.
Yeah. So we're gonna learn something about each other. Oh, by the way, early heads up for next week. So I am not going to be here on Tuesday following the holiday on Monday. Anna Kasparian will be stepping in to guest host the show. We don't have a show on Monday, but I think it would be pretty awesome if you two co-hosted the show together.
Yeah, I think so, too.
We'll have to talk about that and see what's going on with that. But we've got a gigantic show for you. Not only are we gonna give you updates on all the news that happened over the weekend, and it was a pretty big weekend when it comes to political news. We've got updates on the shutdown and Donald Trump's, I don't know the right word. He's falling apart when it comes to this. We were talking before the show about his tweets last night about Elizabeth Warren. It's the sort of thing that I don't want to cover on the show, and yet we might be pulled into it because it is insane.
It was insane.
It is insane, but we'll see. We'll see. We've got the LA teacher strike a little bit later on. An update on the media coverage of Steve King's just open defense of white supremacy. And we're gonna put it in context compared to some other things that the media has focused on quite a bit over the past couple of weeks. And along the way, we also have two awesome guests for you. So in just a little bit, in the next block, the executive director of the Justice Democrats is gonna be joining us. That is Alexandra Rojas, who's gonna be joining us to talk about their first target in 2020 and why they chose that particular target. So that's gonna be very exciting. And then a little bit later on the show, Roland Martin is going to join us and gonna break down some of the news of the weekend, some of the news of the day and stuff like that. Should be a lot of fun.
Yes.
So why don't we jump right into it?
Okay.
Donald Trump wants to project this idea that he is in control of this shutdown thing, which he said when he launched it that it was his and he wouldn't blame anyone. He has since blamed everyone for it,
right,
saying the buck stops everywhere.
Everyone.
And he's totally in control, even though you can map out his deteriorating mental state via Twitter in real time. And he's sort of losing it. And bear in mind, we're in the 24th day now of this shutdown. So this is, by several days, the longest shutdown in US government history. So yay, we're number one in having a government that doesn't function. So that's awesome.
Yay.
Now, hypothetically, you could blame multiple groups for this shutdown, assuming you didn't pay any attention whatsoever to us entering into it. You might think that various people are to blame. But if you talk to the American people, over half, 53%, say the president and his party should shoulder most of the blame for the closures. 29% point their finger at Democrats in Congress. Just 13% of Americans say both sides should be held accountable as the shutdown continues to drag on.
I want to take the phrase both sides and eat it. Like, honestly, I hate it worse than fake news.
Mm-hmm.
At least fake news has become comical. Unfortunately, it's also become deadly. Mm-hmm. So I guess never mind. Actually, I think fake news is just gonna have to take it. Never mind. I'm working things out.
Well, while you are hating fake news, you can eat both sides.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's not been used for something that's just not absolutely ridiculous and offensive.
Yeah, well, look, if you, in the most shallow sense possible, both sides are responsible.
It reminds me
because the Democrats could just give him $100 billion for a wall and the shutdown would end.
Yeah, but like women can like not be sexually harassed if they don't wear low cut shirts.
Thus, both sides are to blame.
Right,
if you're
and
a
that's
moron.
What it sounds like. Yes. Right, exactly. It's like, what?
Good point.
That doesn't work.
Now, let's just point out 29% blame Democrats in Congress, which, by the way, is below what I consider the Trump's core base, which is like 32-36% of the country. That means that even some of them have apparently flipped and say, well, yeah, no, it's Trump. It's Trump. Now, maybe they think that it's a good thing that he's doing it, but they do think that it's his fault. And so that is going on. And bear in mind, like, to say that both sides are responsible is to have a memory only slightly longer than a goldfish's. Because of course, this shutdown, while it's now on its 24th day, that was less than a month ago. And we remember that it started when Republicans had unified control of government. When the Senate unanimously passed a budget that Donald Trump had previously signed off for, Now the Republicans in the House voted it down, so that's their fault. Now the Democrats are in, they vote for it. So all he has to do is sign off on a budget that all of the Republicans in the Senate and he had previously agreed to. He chooses not to. So to look at that situation and say it's the Democrats' fault is insane.
It's right. It's not good journalism. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's what it's being portrayed in a lot of news stories. It's not good journalism because then essentially Congress is not doing their jobs. Like Democrats in Congress are not doing their jobs. If this is not what, you know, the people who voted you in there, if this is not what they want, if this is not the best budget, if this is not the most responsible thing, if this is racist, don't vote for it.
Yeah.
And there's no focus at all on that. The Senate is just refusing to call his bluff. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah, in terms of vetoing it?
Yeah.
Well, we might come to that.
Yeah.
We might come to that. Right now, they apparently believe that there's still a chance that he's going to come out victorious on this. I think most of the country has moved on from that position, but some Republicans in the Senate still believe it. And I think whether he wants to admit it or not, I think that he is feeling it now. And that comes through in a couple of different ways over the weekend. So let's break down some of the ways that he is apparently cracking under the pressure. So he said this, and it's both kind of crazy and a little bit sad. It almost makes you feel for him. He said on Twitter, "I just watched a fake reporter from the Amazon Washington Post say the White House is, quote, chaotic. There does not seem to be a strategy for the shutdown. There is no plan. The fakes always like talking chaos." What is he, Holden Caulfield? There is none. In fact, there's almost nobody in the White House but me. And that's just, first of all, you think the White House is chaotic? It can't be chaotic. There's nobody here.
Right.
It's the government, you weirdo. You're not Willy Wonka. There should be people there. So that's weird. And second of all, it reminds me before Christmas where he's like, poor me, I'm alone in the White House.
Right.
You have a family.
The other part, like there was, you know, like he's like, you know, I wish I could show you the beauty. I mean, you can take a picture. You're on Twitter. You could tweet it, a picture. Just tweet a picture.
You can.
Like, right?
And let me just make clear before trolls in the comments, I know about Oompa Loompas. I do get it. So he goes on to say, "I do have a plan on the shutdown, but I love this. But to understand that plan, you would have to understand the fact that I won the election and I promised safety and security for the American people. Part of that promise was a wall at the southern border. Elections have consequences."
Also, part of that promise was that Mexico would pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the major part of the promise.
That was, I think,
the biggest part of the promise. That's what people were so focused on, that you said, not only are you gonna get this done, but that America's not gonna suffer because of it, because you're such a businessman and you're such a negotiator that Mexico's gonna pay for it.
Yeah.
You can't like pick and choose which parts of your words that you wanna now like own. Wait, what?
You're 100% right, but I also think you're being a little bit too easy on him.
Okay.
In terms of how absurd that is. Look, elections have consequences is totally a phrase. I totally get it.
We know that now.
That's true. But it's not any election.
Right.
There was once an election has consequences. It means the most recent one. That's what the phrase means. We've had another election since then. An election that did not have to be about the border or immigration or border security or anything like that. You chose to try to make it like that in the weeks leading up to the election. You dispatched the military to the border. You made up the thing about the caravan. You talked about it nonstop. And you lost control of the House in a gigantic wave of elections. So sorry, elections have consequences. You wanted it to be about the wall. Looks like if it's about the wall, the people don't support you. And we know that only like 1/3 of the American public actually supports building the wall anyway or passing any sort of budget if it includes wall
funding.
And
we're working on them, okay?
Exactly, we're working on them. So just ridiculous. It's like last week when he said the buck stops with everyone. It's like he sort of is interested in history, but doesn't quite get how the language works. There is one other little bit that shows that I think that he's starting to fray along the edges just a little bit. It's a video from this weekend. Here it is.
"Well, I haven't actually left the White House in months, and in all fairness, I'm doing a lot of other work. It's not just that, but that's a very important element of what I'm doing because we have to get the southern border done. And I've been here virtually every night, I guess every night, other than one day I flew to Iraq and then to Germany to see our troops.
Yes.
And it was great to see them, was great. The level of love they have for this country is incredible. So I flew and then came back. I'm not even sure I actually missed a night per se, but basically I've been here for many months in the White House, and I, you know, I'm a worker. I'm like you. I'm a worker.
You are
and
a worker.
Frankly, I'm.
Okay, so that last quote from Pierre was just sad. I know you are a worker. Okay, so he says, you know, I haven't left for months. He acknowledges that he took a trip to the Middle East briefly. He also, just a couple of days ago, went down to the border. What are you talking? Like, it's the easy thing is to say that this is a sign of deteriorating mental health, which it could be. I don't think that that's actually what it is. I think it is that this guy who got elected on the idea that he is a strong alpha male is just constantly looking for pity.
That,
and so it's not that he doesn't understand that he's left many times in the last few months. It's that he just wants people to feel sorry for him, like with that previous tweet and like with the tweet about Christmas. This is the guy who's supposed to be so strong that he can just bowl over the Democrats and get his wall funding while looking for pity because, oh, you have to be in the White House.
Wait, does it sound like someone who just doesn't respect the office of the presidency? Like, I like liken that to like the idea that you come to work every day and at noon you're like, oh, I haven't left this chair all day. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, there are many people who would love to be in the White House, and I would give it to literally any of them right now. Anyway, we do have to take our first break, but when we come back, our first guest will be joining us from the Justice Democrats, breaking down their first target in the 2020 election. Very exciting news after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
In the 2018 election, the Justice Democrats brought us a number of big names now making news on literally a daily basis, including new representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. We talked with, you know, Ro Khanna a lot. Some big names. So begs the question, now that we're getting into the 2020 election, who can we expect them to put forward in this next election? And perhaps more importantly, who are they gonna have to take down along the way? And so joining us to help break down the path going forward is the executive director of the Justice Democrats, Alexandra Rojas. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, John.
Very glad to have you here. So I saw that just a couple of days ago, the Justice Democrats announced who their first target in the 2020 election would be. So who is that, and why did you choose this particular incumbent?
Yeah, it's Henry Cuellar out in Texas's 28th congressional district. And for us, you know, despite representing one of the safest Democratic seats in the country, it actually went plus 20 for Hillary Clinton. Representative Cuellar of Texas 28 has been a consistent ally of the Republican Party and Donald Trump. He's voted about almost 70% of the time with them. He's received a rating from the NRA. He's voted with Republicans consistently to ban federal funds for abortion services. He's a corporate Democrat through and through, taking private prison and detention money, as well as Koch brothers backed PAC money. And he's voted against Dreamers before. And it sounds like very much like a Texas Republican, but he's not. He's actually a Democrat in the Democratic Party and has been there for several cycles. And so we're looking to recruit a progressive working class grassroots challenger to a Democrat that clearly does not represent our party and is standing Donald Trump the way that we need to in this crucial moment.
So I want to break down a couple of aspects of him as a candidate. But starting off with the voting with Donald Trump close to 70% of the time, has he presented any sort of reason or excuse for why he has racked up that statistic?
No, I mean, it's actually been interesting in the days of response. We're definitely like trying to keep a lookout, like what is he, where's the unity argument, which is a lot of the times that we're seeing like establishment Democrats hail at Alexandria right now, right? They need to rein her in. And I think he put out a statement recently that talked about the diversity of thought. And I know he's put out previous statements when he got challenged last time, because he was actually challenged a few cycles ago. And he talked about, again, that Democrats shouldn't eat their own. But what's funny about this particular person in general, too, is that he's actually, back in 2018, not too long ago, fundraised on the GOP for John Carter, who was a far-right Republican birther, against a progressive Democrat veteran who was running out there, too. So there's really no justification, and I call on Democratic leadership like Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer to justify why this particular Democrat does not need to be challenged.
Yeah, I think that when you help fundraise for a Republican candidate, you lose the moral high ground on not challenging Democrats in primary elections. So I also want to talk about his sources of funding, because that's obviously a very important qualification for becoming a Justice Democrat. Where does he get his political donations from?
He is the number one Democrat that takes fossil fuel and corporate money. He's taken private detention center money, and the GEO Group is actually a facility that's located in his district that he takes money from as well. And just across the board, right, we can see that by far he is leading in corporate PAC and lobbyist contribution from a number like Wall Street, from fossil fuel to private prison and private detention. And at a time where we're literally seeing human rights abuses and locking children in cages right at the border, there's no reason why he is not the champion, right, of creating a legal pathway to citizenship, having a Clean Dream Act, and showing the nation of what's happening right now with ICE and their human rights abuses.
So I want to take a bit of a step back, because obviously you're going to launch this once you find the right candidate, you're going to launch a primary challenge against him, but there will be many. So when you're choosing where to target, where to put your resources, is it primarily a pragmatic exercise of figuring out who might be vulnerable, how blue a district is, that sort of thing? Or is it primarily ideological, that this person is the exact inverse of a progressive in terms of the Democratic Party, where they get their funding from, things like that?
Yeah, I think it's a blend of all of those things, right? I think we have to be idealistic in we're challenging incumbent Democrats, right? And so we have to think big about the way that we run campaigns and who we challenge to shift the Overton window, like we've seen on Green New Deal, abolish ICE, and a number of these ideas that we're pushing for that happen in competitive primaries. But I think paramount, like you said, is ideological. And I think that's what makes Justice Democrats so different, is that we do embrace the idea of a litmus test. We have a platform that's calling for solutions as big as the problems that we're facing. Like, you know, when we talk about climate change and the IPCC report saying that we have only 12 years left, we have to offer solutions like a Green New Deal. When we see our healthcare crisis and 60% of Americans going bankrupt because they can't afford to pay their medical bills, we have to offer expanded and improved Medicare for all. So we're going to continue to keep that at the forefront and paramount to our process. But I think at the same time, we're looking for those people that are, you know, make up the fabric of our all parts of our economy and our society, and the candidate and finding real solutions that are going to be a part of this mission-driven team in Congress that's going to legislate a lot of what we're talking about into reality is also really important. So I think there's a layer of district analysis that's been looking at places where we did really well, places where we did not do really well. I think it's looking at you know, the voting records of all of these past incumbent Democrats, and then also just our general theory and approach to primaries, and whether it's you know, in the Democratic for a Democratic seat or a Republican held seat, I think is that no incumbent is beholden to their seat, and that in a healthy and thriving democracy, right, we can have these robust policy discussions and create a vision of what, you know, the American people want to see our nation become. And I think that's sort of the place that we see ourselves right now is this sort of battle within the Democratic Party, and we're trying to help find ourselves again, right? Even before the system lost over the past decade, thousands of seats up and down the ballot, and so we're trying to we're trying to bring out the best in Democrats, if you will.
Well, Alexandra, thank you so much both for the work you do for the Justice Democrats, also joining us. Hopefully we can have you back on in the near future and talk a little bit more as you identify more targets and start to accrue some awesome candidates.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, LA has begun its teacher strike, absolutely massive strike going on. We're going to lay out what the teachers are asking for, how the school district is responding, and then much more for you after this. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Damage Report. As of today, LA is under the effects of the new LA teacher strike. We've been anticipating it for a few days. There was the possibility in the days leading up to it that some sort of accommodation might be reached between the teachers' unions and the school district, but apparently that is not the case. And so as of today, 32,000 LA teachers are on strike, which is a lot of people in LA. That's a lot of teachers. And a lot of power too, by the way. That affects 600,000 students, although the school district says, you're seeing there that they are going to be taught by 2,000 reassigned administrators and about 400 substitute teachers, which even if you were to assume that each one of those represents a regular teacher, the numbers are not on their side.
Right, now, it's not. There's going to be so many. You're going to have 10 classes together.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be like where I went to college, classes of 5,000 people.
Same.
But anyway, let's talk about why this came about. Mm-hmm. So Arlene Inoue, Secretary of the Union for the United Teachers LA, said this weekend that the strike was a, quote, last resort after teachers had been bargaining with the LA Unified School District for close to 2 years without reaching an agreement. The teachers union says that the school district has $1.86 billion in reserves, and the school district says it does not have the money to improve our schools, to include lower class sizes, accountability for charter schools, and a real investment in school safety, vital staffing, and educational programs, despite that gigantic reserve. They want them to pull from those reserves to increase school staffing, lower class sizes, and boost teacher salaries by 6.5%. Because apparently since 2008, the cost of living in LA has increased by 27%. And that trend does not seem like it's gonna stop anytime soon. And so if you are not raising the pay of teachers, I mean, they're already not paid particularly well. In a place like LA, it's gonna be increasingly difficult to merely survive.
But when you break that down, essentially these teachers are going on strike because they are demanding the ability to best educate your children. Mm-hmm. Like that's really what it comes down to.
Well, to be able to do it without getting additional jobs too.
Well, right, but I mean, you can't, if you can't occasionally take your do your lesson plan on during your free time, if you're exhausted because you're, I mean, all of this is, they want better care.
They want to be able to do their job.
They want to be able to do their job, yeah. They want certain, they want better hires. They want nurses staffed at every location. They want, you know, I mean.
Exactly. Now, the school district is trying to allay people's fears about how this might impact their kids' education, saying elementary, middle, and high schools will be open. Instruction will continue and meals will be served tomorrow and throughout the strike. Early education centers will be open only to special needs students, and preschool sites will be closed. But again, based on the numbers that we talked about earlier, it remains to be seen how able they will be to continue with their normal course.
And I mean, right, it's gonna be daycare. Strike, what?
Exactly. But but with 32,000 in one city, like, that is a powerful striking movement. We've seen over the past couple of years teacher strikes in a number of different states that were generally but not uniformly successful in getting what they wanted. It seems like if you were gonna be betting, I would probably put my money on the teachers. And it's interesting that considering the size of LA, only a couple of politicians on sort of a national scale or known nationally have actually come out in favor of them. One is Bernie Sanders, who says, I stand in solidarity with the UT LA Now teachers in their fight for fair pay, smaller classroom sizes, and stipends for materials and supplies. Teaching is one of the most valuable and indispensable professions. We need to treat educators with respect and dignity. And perhaps not surprisingly, on the House side, Ro Khanna, a friend of the show, says, "I stand in solidarity with LA teachers who are preparing to strike for higher pay, smaller class sizes, and more support staff. Every student deserves a quality education, and every teacher deserves fair pay for their hard work." Well, I would also say that while this is going on, Gavin Newsom, who has been rolling out all these big ideas for housing and like dealing with climate change, let's get a big idea for education in California. LA could probably use the help, and so perhaps if they strike long enough, then perhaps it can take over state level importance.
And just even that last piece of Ro Khanna's tweet. Why do we keep having to tell people this? Mm-hmm. Just that last bit where it was just like students deserve, I'm paraphrasing, but like what is it? A quality education and every teacher deserves fair pay for their hard work. That is the most like duh statement ever. And we continuously have to say that and bring that to light. That's sad.
Well, yes, and it's especially sad that, like, let's just keep it real. Most people, whether consciously or not, whether they think it or not, their approach to teachers is they are trash people. Mm-hmm. Like they're not important. Like,
which is
sort of sad that this is where you had your career had to go, that you'd have to do this. Like, it's literally the people who train all Americans in the adults they will someday be.
Create us.
And the thing is,
what? They help our parents, form us, and like what?
Yeah, they help us figure out where we're gonna go career wise. They shape our brains during the time when they're developing.
Sometimes they step in when parents can't.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so while we sort of as a whole, like for the most part, are putting forward the idea that they don't matter in terms of how we pay them. Mm-hmm. Those with the most money and influence and political power obviously do get it, because they will pay crazy amounts to not send their kids to these schools. Oh. They're willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars every year to send their kids to the best possible schools. So those people who are in many ways nationally and at a state level making decisions for teacher pay, they know all too well how important teachers are, and they pay accordingly on a personal level. They just don't necessarily want their taxes to be raised so that all of us get better teachers. So that's sort of sad. Any other thoughts?
That's it.
Before we move on, I just want to briefly mention this. I don't know, we don't have much time, but you might recall a GoFundMe was set up to build the wall. They wanted to raise $1 billion, which is ambitious on GoFundMe. And turns out they didn't quite raise it all, the $1 billion that they wanted to raise. But they did raise $20 million, which is absurd. And is, I think, itself an indictment of America generally. But they didn't reach the $1 billion, so it is being shut down. But the guy who set it up is not dissuaded by this. It's not a huge setback from his point of view. Brian Colphage, who set it up, said that he had reached out to several experts in law, politics, national security, construction, finance. Oh, several, really? And created a team that has spent countless hours of the holidays reviewing all issues pertaining to the construction of a southern border wall. And so he says that while the $20 million that they've raised so far in GoFundMe will be refunded to the people, they are going to set up their own organization so that you can give that group money. And then rather than trying to give it to the government, which they finally concluded they can't really do, they are going to independently build a wall on the southern border. Mm-hmm.
This is that's big. Ridiculous. I just wish GoFundMe had some clause in there for stupid things like this. That was like, if you don't get $1 billion, we're gonna have to give Flint clean water with your money. Like, you know what I mean?
That might be hard to do in practice. I will say, look, based on what you said, if we could raise $20 million for a wall, is there a big GoFundMe to pull out all the pipes in Flint and all the other areas? I mean, Flint is obviously that's the prototypical case, but we know that this is a problem all over the place. LA has a gigantic problem with lead poisoning its water supplies. So if we could build a wall, could we fix our pipes?
People care less about helping the unfortunate than they do, like, funding their hatred.
Yeah.
Because if this was about helping people, then we wouldn't be trying to punish asylum seekers. I mean,
I have given up on getting people to care about the less fortunate in terms of this sort, in this particular issue, but care about yourself. You drink water, you bathe in water. Do you want lead in your water? And I'm not generally our fans obviously care about. I'm not talking to you, but I'm talking to the people who don't prioritize it at all.
Right.
You and your family and your friends and your children all have to drink that stuff. It is not just poor people. That should be enough. But if it's not, it's you and everyone you know as well. You're not cracking Aquafina every time you take a shower or a bath. You know, you drink smart water. Act smart when it comes to water.
Act smart. Don't just drink smart water.
It's
act
frustrating.
Smart. Yes. That's good stuff.
Yeah, and so, I just want to give a little bit more details to give Brian Colphage, who, look, giving him the entire benefit of the doubt, he cares about the border, he wants to secure it or whatever. It is going to be hard to convince enough landowners along the southern border to build a wall. That is a big project. I would say, like, that's like building a space elevator or something. Like, this is pretty complex, but he's going to try to do it. You know, more power to him. I would say that if it's under GoFundMe, I think there's probably more independent, transparent accountability for the money. When this guy sets up his own thing, like if you're giving money to this, what are the odds that you're not gonna be ripped off, honestly? And I'm not even saying that he's going into it wanting to rip off people. But I don't think it's crazy to say the wall is not going to be built.
Right, it just
and yet
totally
money
defies
will
logic,
be donated. Right. So where does that money go?
Right.
Best case scenario, no fraud, no con, it goes to him and other people getting a paycheck. So honestly, you can donate the money if you want. It is far more likely to enrich people working on a wall than to actually build a wall.
You ever buy something just for the feeling? You know how it feels to like buy dumb stuff in Target?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is. It's like pressing the button, knowing that this is not logical, but it's like, yeah, racism. Like it makes some people feel good. I'm not saying everybody.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I imagine that people know that this just doesn't even make any sense. It just felt good.
And it feels good to do it. That's what they're buying.
To just, that emotion to be able to say, yeah, we're gonna fund it ourselves, even though it's just not even really possible. And it's not, I know nothing about how this process could work but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, not only do I know that feeling, but I'm reminded of that feeling every month because a couple of years ago when Donald Trump attacked Vanity Fair, I subscribed to it, but it turns out I don't read Vanity Fair. I just get Vanity Fair.
That is really good.
No, I know. It's just I don't read magazines. I can't.
So
I don't
you
read
did
magazines.
It because it felt good.
It did. Uh-huh. And you know, I support journalism and all that stuff. But anyway, we do have to take a break. But the good thing is that on the other side of this block, we're going to be joined by Roland Martin, who's going to be joining us to break down some of the big news of the weekend after this. There is still so much more from the weekend we haven't yet gotten to cover.
So
we're very lucky that joining us to help do that is Roland Martin, host of Roland Martin Unfiltered. Roland, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
It's as good as it can be in America. But we're very glad to have you here.
The bar is low, you know, it's going well.
Yeah. So very excited to have you here for the first time. And I wanted to start off by talking about there was a couple of people announcing they'd be running for president the past week. The most recent was Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio and secretary of HUD under Barack Obama. What do you think about his chances and how he could help to shape the primary based on his experience?
Well, it's no surprise that he decided to run for president. I always said you're going to have anywhere from 12 to 14 people who are going to be running for president. Certainly, he is young, he's Latino. He brings the credibility of being a former mayor, but also, of course, HUD secretary. What I am surprised, though, is that you did not see him building some sort of grassroots initiative over the last 2 or 3 years, specifically when it comes to driving Latino voters. This year's election is also going to be a lot different because in the past, it's always been about Iowa and New Hampshire. But because other states moved up their primaries and then their early voting start. So, for instance, before they even go to vote in Iowa, early voting will already start in California. And so this totally dramatically changes the map. And I think it actually favors candidates who are Black and Latino because, frankly, you're not pretty much living in two all white states. or nearly all white states.
Yeah, I think that that is a huge factor that I actually have not heard talked about very often, but that is going to be absolutely massive. I did want to ask you, so Castro announced, we had Tulsi Gabbard like a day before. I mean, you've covered multiple elections. We're getting started very early. The debates start in like 3 days. I don't know, it's like 6 months or whatever, but very early. How do you think this really long extended primary could influence the candidate we end up with?
Yeah, but it's not actually that long. So you're only talking about being moved up a month. Remember, in 2008, Hillary Clinton announced her exploratory committee in January. Then Senator Barack Obama unveiled his campaign in Springfield, Illinois. It was cold as hell that day I was there in February. And so we're really only talking about it being moved up anywhere from three weeks or so. And so we saw what that looked like in 2008, when you had a significant number of candidates. Remember, we had debates in the month of July in 2008. And I have to remind everybody, Obama was raising lots of money, but he was far behind Hillary Clinton all the way through, I think it was around August or September. And then everything changed at the debate in Iowa when she was asked the question about driver's licenses for undocumented workers. And so that's what changed it. And so this is no surprise. I think actually it helps Democrats, because remember, when you have this many people with this much runway, what they're doing is appealing to various constituencies. And so they are getting them excited. They're operating as volunteers, as donors. And so it helps the party because you're expanding the number of people who you're trying to reach to come out and vote.
Hey, Roland, good morning. I maybe have kind of a two-parter question. I wanted your thoughts on the picture that went viral this weekend of CBS's election team of reporters and producers. And then what kind of ties into that, I wonder, as an example of like the importance of diversity, the Washington Post reporter, because I know you're an alpha, and yes, the Washington Post reporter that went viral with her, I would say like just negative comments on what we know is the AKA Skiwi. But she called it a screech at the Kamala Harris event.
So I'll deal with the first question and then the second one. First of all, CBS. I'm vice president digital for the National Association of Black Journalists. And when we saw that photo, obviously we were alarmed, and we immediately sent emails. I emailed David Rose, the president of CBS News, or the outgoing president. Susan Zirinsky is coming in. Our president, Sarah Glover, she reached out to Susan, and also our vice president for broadcast, Dorothy Tucker, reached out to Kim Godwin, who was a vice president, who's also over diversity. We also have a couple of things. You have the number two person at CBS News, who's African American. The managing editor of the Washington DC Bureau is African American as well. So CBS has told us that this list isn't the final list. The problem is that's the way they made it seem by releasing that graphic. And so there are those of us who are saying, if it's not final, why did you release this graphic? And so they certainly realize there's a problem. But this also speaks to, let's just be real frank, the whiteness of political reporting in this country. If you want to go to the White House, it's the White House, that's the name of it, but also called the White House Press, the White House White Press Corps. When you look at those who cover Capitol Hill, the reality is African Americans are not provided the same level of opportunities, the tap on the shoulder that you see all across the place. We also know that the people who are campaign embeds also go on to become White House correspondents or other significant positions. And that's why this is important. So CBS realizes they have a problem. They're certainly going to address this. Let me deal with the Washington Post deal. So a lot of people have been making a big deal out of this, saying, oh my God, she said screech. Look, it's a lot of white folks don't have anything about black people, okay? Who also don't understand the nuances of black sororities and fraternities. And so I saw the tweet. I saw when she's deleted it. I actually responded to her tweet saying, look, frankly, it's no big deal. But here's what I appreciate. I appreciate that she went, okay, I didn't know. Now I'm educated about it. And that's the case. And so it is not surprising that that we live in a world that things that happen within a black context, white folks don't have any clue about. That's called the history of America. And so she didn't get defensive. She didn't get all ticked off. She simply said, hey, I didn't know. There you go. And so, look, I think that it is important that we do have African-Americans who are in critical positions. So I can go all the way back to 1984 and 88 when Reverend Jackson ran in 84. That was really the first time you had African-Americans who were covering presidential campaigns. So black candidates have made a difference. His run in 84, his run in 88, that really changed African-Americans for mainstream. You always had folks in the black press who were covering presidential campaigns. And so I think the fundamental issue we have here, though, is that mainstream media does not want to acknowledge its whiteness. When you look in the executive suites of these networks, of these digital operations, of these newspapers, guess what? It's mighty white and it's mighty male, and that's the problem. Mainstream media in America does not look like America, which is why they often screw things up in this country, which is also why that the comment by a freshman congresswoman from Detroit using the word MF towards Trump got 5 times more coverage than white supremacist Steve King. Let's see how media today covers Donald Trump tweeting a white supremacist column by white supremacist Pat Buchanan. And again, that's the blind spot of these media executives, because frankly, they don't see it because they don't understand it.
You know, it's fascinating that you brought that up, because I was actually, that was going to be my next question. Unfortunately, we don't have time, but I will say that I predict that they will not make a big deal out of Trump advancing this white nationalist friendly websites rhetoric and all that. But Roland, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating to talk to you. Hopefully we can have you on again in the future to help break down more politics.
Glad to join you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little bit more news to finish out the hour after this. Last week, sitting Republican Congressman Steve King was interviewed by the New York Times, and in it, he defended the concept of white supremacy and didn't see why it's so offensive, saying, "White nationalists, white supremacists, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive? Why did I sit in classes teaching me about the merits of our history and our civilization if none of it was going to sink into my big dumb head?" He didn't say that part, but that's what I got out of it, because he doesn't seem to understand why white supremacy is a bad thing or why people might be a little bit sensitive about it. But that's fine, we understand that. The question then falls to the media. Are you going to make him answer for these things that he said? Are you going to cover it? It turns out that in the 24-hour period after he said it, the media was mostly meh about it. They didn't really care. Fox News, who loves to have Steve King on, by the way, when he's not defending white supremacy as explicitly as he did right there, they devoted a total of 42 seconds to the story that day. The only segment, which was on Special Report with Bret Baier, was framed as Republican Congressman Steve King is fighting back against the New York Times article, which helpfully does not tell you what he's fighting back against. Let's see, NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt, they put out a tweet saying, "Now on NBC Nightly News, Casey speaks with GOP Rep Steve King about his controversial comments in a New York Times interview, which some people are calling racist." For some reason.
That's the worst part about news coverage. What?
Why are they calling it racist? I don't know.
Some people have a problem with this.
Yeah, it's weird. So mostly they were just not interested in a sitting politician saying white supremacy, what's the issue?
Because the president essentially said it a few months ago. So
yeah, he gets away with it, okay? It's fine that he's a fascist white supremacist, doesn't matter. But other people should not get away with it. And so look, to put it in context, Media Matters did a great job of, as we at the time were saying, I wonder how they will cover this in comparison to Rashida Tlaib using a curse word. And it turns out, doesn't make the media look good. If we bring up this chart from Media Matters, CNN talked about it for 14 minutes, which is pretty good. But they talked about Rashida Tlaib's comments for over an hour. Fox News, as we said, 42 seconds. They talked about Rashida Tlaib for almost an hour. And MSNBC, which talked about Rashida Tlaib the least, also about 14 minutes. So in all of these cases, they talked about Rashida Tlaib far more. And that is just the 24-hour period after the comments came out in each case.
Right, which is upsetting. There's no defense of that. Mm-hmm. I think Brian Stelter kind of tweeted something out saying, you know, it was just 24 hours. Like, I'm watching the segment on it right now. But the problem is that it's 24 hours.
Yeah.
Any 24 hours.
Which is more consequential, that she swore or that he might be a white supremacist?
Right, we have like respectability politics and racism.
Yeah.
And
you know what's in civil white supremacy, I think. Okay, so pathetic by the media. I do want to talk a little bit about, I said that if you guys were to send in reviews for the podcast to iTunes, I would read some, and there's some good ones, by the way. So the Bri Star says, among other things, I love the show. Brooke and JR are two of my favorite co-hosts. Keep up the good work.
Aw, so Bri Star, big fan of you.
And then I love this by Evertosser, who says, I'm very much of a progressive, and I hate it when people mince words in the name of civility at the expense of serious threats to the well-being of others. But by the same token, I despise angry rhetoric not backed by facts or good arguments. The damage report is just what the doctor ordered, as well as most of the other TYT shows. The hosts make their presentation in an off-the-cuff manner rather than reading off a teleprompter. They do not sacrifice research and knowledge of the topic or issue at hand. Their informal presentation, coupled with a willingness to tell it like it is and be backed by research, makes this show a most appealing option for those sick of cable news calling everything, even rather than being journalists and finding the truth. They have a progressive slant here, but it is justified by the information provided. Thank you so much for what you said.
That's awesome.
Absolutely awesome. And that's what we're trying to do. And actually, the segment we just ended with about Steve King shows how the media often both sides things. Right. We try not to do that. So thank you. For those of you who haven't rated and reviewed the podcast, please do so. If you do, we might read your review on the show in the near future. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for always having me. I'm glad to be able to be a part of this greatness, John.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for watching, everybody. We will see you tomorrow with much, much more. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.